This is Dylan FM, a Freak Music Club podcast. I'm Bob Dylan. If you love Dylan, you're in the right place. This season, we're going deep on Time Out of Mind to celebrate its 25th anniversary. Here's your host, Craig Danieloff.
Chances are that you've listened to Time Out of Mind many times, a few dozen, a few hundred. It's an album that people seem to feel. It gets a reaction. And it's full of lines that land and linger. We've learned that this album was the beginning of something for Dylan, a new way of writing songs, of synthesizing ideas and images and lines that he loves. Scott Warmoth told us something about this a few episodes ago, focusing primarily on Dylan's application of the work of Henry Rollins via lines and expressions that appear in a number of songs. But the inspiration, influence, references, thievery, and even the intertextualization go much further. And today's guest is going to help us see a lot more of that. Jochen Markhorst is the author of quite a few Dylan books. We'll get to more of those later. But one is called Time Out of Mind, The Rising of an Old Master. In this book, he dutifully walks through every song on the album and a bunch that were recorded at that time that aren't on the album and shares stories and insights into how they link to all kinds of other writers and artists and musicians and poets. For me, reading this book gave the feeling of a new bootleg series box set when suddenly all kinds of new things are revealed about an old and loved work. It'll make you smile, shake your head, think, and become even more astounded by Bob Dylan and his work. If you're like me, it will also greatly impress you in terms of the author's own breadth of knowledge and his ability to connect, synthesize, and explain what he knows to us readers. Here are a few of the things that I learned. "I'm sick of love" is a Bible quote. The first line in "Standing in the Doorway" is an inversion of a line from The Great Gatsby. There may be a link, an echo, or another inversion going on between a line in "Million Miles" and a line in Dylan's own "One Too Many Mornings." Dean Martin may have provided the melody for "Make You Feel My Love." And the "Some Kind of Pain" line in "Not Dark Yet" echoes statements that were previously made by artists ranging from Vincent van Gogh to Frida Kahlo and writers such as Kafka. Most of these and hundreds of similar facts and relationships and ideas were completely new to me. What he does for us, and what is really an amazing gift if you care about this album, is give the lyrics context. He tells us about the places where similar language and themes were used. He relates phrases to other songs, to literature and poetry and art, and he exposes the history of similar ideas and expressions, some spread over thousands of years and some from elsewhere in Dylan's own catalog. Is any of this necessary to appreciate or even understand Time Out of Mind? No. But what it does do is expand the ways you can think about these songs and this album. It does so in the broadest sense and in the most detailed ways. I should be clear, of course, that Jochen is one of many writers and critics who offer us this additional richness. Michael Gray, Christopher Ricks, Greil Marcus, Paul Williams, Richard Thomas, and the rest of the best of the Dylan scholars do this as well. It would be a mistake to say that this type of exploration explains or decodes the album. I'm fairly certain that's not a claim that Jochen or any of these others would make, but it offers at least two potential benefits, and you can decide for yourself on the magnitude or the proportions. First, it shows that so many of these ideas and a good number of really specific lines refer or echo back to different and bigger things. Dylan is likely using them in part as a shorthand to carry a lot more meaning than the words can do in the space available if they didn't have this context. Think of it as bonus content. And secondly, all of this behind-the-scenes information shows us that there are many more ways to think about and listen to and experience these songs than many of us have been doing. If you're like me and not extremely well-versed in all of recorded music, the history of poetry, all the best prose, and all of the art created over the last few centuries, then what a book like this does is acts like a recorded tour guide at the museum. It can transform a painting that you might glance at and walk by in 10 or 15 seconds into a rich set of stories and images and meanings that make it far more interesting and justify spending a lot more time and thought, and that ultimately helps you to enjoy or at least appreciate it a lot more. Some of it is new facts and details, but in some ways, it's just as much about bringing out the overall flavor and tone. Hardcore Dylan freaks may be familiar with Jochen Marquardt's work, as he is incredibly prolific. He writes detailed analyses of many Dylan songs, often as a series of blog posts, at the Untold Dylan website. But he's assembled these posts into 15 different books collecting writings on single Dylan albums, or in some cases, a single Dylan song. Today, we're talking about Time Out of Mind, but you can read or buy his similarly impressive deep dives on Street Legal, Blood on the Tracks, The Song Mississippi, or his latest A Rough and Rowdy Ways song, Crossing the Rubicon. Check the show notes for links to both the free online versions and the affordable, and I think easier to consume, published books that are available from Amazon. Jochen lives in the Netherlands, where he teaches language training courses and works as a translator. As you'll hear in this lively and charming presentation, he's a passionate Dylan fan. In this talk, Jochen shares a little bit of what he learned about the song Cold Irons Bound. Now here's Jochen Marquardt.
It does have a very beautiful genesis, I think, this particular song, and a very rich text. Okay, the story of Cold Irons Bound. The story of Cold Irons Bound starts with a drummer, David Kemper. And we know the story thanks to a beautiful interview series in Uncut, the magazine. In 2008, they published a 13-part interview series on Telltale Signs, on part 8 of the bootleg series. And in this series, they talked to guys like Daniel Anema, the producer, and to Howard Burns, the engineer, and Jim Keltner, the drummer, and also to David Kemper, the drummer on Cold Irons Bound. David Kemper. It was a really great band, David Kemper says. And I'm sorry not to be in it today. I miss Bob, and I miss that band. He does open the doors to his heart in this interview. But not only does he open the doors to his heart, he tells a particular story about the genesis of Cold Irons Bound. And this is just one of the very many beautiful anecdotes, amusing most, the inside information we get in this interview series, the intimate glimpses. But most of all, and I'm most fascinated by the glimpses into the working method of Bob Dylan. That's what fascinates me. I'm mainly fascinated by the songs. David Kemper was his drummer from 1996 to 2003, I believe. And he tells about the making of Cold Irons Bound the following. So he remembers the recording day, January 1997, at the Criteria Studios in Miami. He remembers he was earlier this particular day. He is alone in the studio. He starts drumming. He calls it a variation on a pattern I heard on my way here, a disco record with a Cuban beat. And then he tells, so I was playing this drum beat, and then Bob snuck up behind me and said, what are you playing? I said, hey Bob, how are you doing today? And he said, no, don't stop. What are you playing? I said, it's a beat. I'm just writing it right now. Don't stop it. Keep doing it. And he went and he got a yellow pad of paper and he sat next to the drums and he just started writing. And he wrote for maybe 10 minutes. And then he said, will you remember that? And I said, yeah, I got it. And then he said, all right, everybody, come on in. I want to put this down. A disco record with a Cuban beat. It can be heard in it. Miami Sound Machine, Bad Boy, something like that. And despite this not so subtle addition by David Kemper, I'm just writing it right now. He never gets a credit, nor gets Gloria Estefan a credit for that matter. Anyway, Kemper suggests that this particular drum pattern inspires Dylan so much so that he hears a song in it and comes up with complete lyrics for Cold Irons Bound in 10 minutes. It is in line with more anecdotes we know about Dylan's working method. Anecdotes that tell how amazingly fast Dylan can produce lyrics. We've heard them before, but it's still fascinating. And as far as possible, it is insightful. It gives us a glimpse into the working method of the mind of a Nobel Prize winning poet. After the first two lines, it is already pretty clear what the inspired Dylan has in mind today. I'm beginning to hear voices and there's no one around. Well, I'm all used up and the fields have turned brown. I went to church on Sunday and she passed by. My love for her is taking such a long time to die. The fields have turned brown. It's quite a giveaway. I'm beginning to hear voices. It's the song by the Stanley Brothers, Dylan's bluegrass heroes, who we encounter a few times here on this album, on Time Out of Mind, in Make You Feel My Love, for example, the Highway of Regret, that's from a Stanley Brothers song. But this particular song, The Fields Have Turned Brown, that seems to be haunting Dylan's mind in these days. It's exactly the same song that he quotes in the telegram he sends Dr. Ralph Stanley 2 months earlier, November 1996, which we know thanks to the autobiography by Dr. Ralph Stanley, the Man of Constant Sorrow book. In this book, Dylan is mentioned quite often because Ralph Stanley is rightly quite proud of the fact that Dylan admires him so much. And he mentions this telegram from 1996 twice. And the second time, he reveals the complete content of Stanley. They had a big celebration for me in Nashville in honor of my 50th anniversary as a professional musician. There was a fancy reception at the Country Music Hall of Fame with all kinds of friends from down through the years and former Clinch Mountain Boys there to greet me. Then I played a show with my band at the Grand Ole Opry. During the show, Opry host Del Reeves announced to the crowd he had a telegram a special fan from New York City had sent. The telegram said, "Dear Dr. Ralph, the fields have turned brown. Not for you, though. You'll live forever. Best wishes, Bob Dylan." That was something I didn't expect, and it was a wonderful surprise. I know what Bob meant in this message, and it really touched my heart. I know he meant my music would be around long after I'm dead and gone. And just as gladly, also twice, he recalls that we sang together on Lonesome River for the Clinch Mountain Country album. And that, twice also, Bob Dylan told me it was the highlight of his career when he sang with me on Lonesome River. That duet was recorded in November 1997, 10 months after the recording of Cold Iron's Bound. Remarkable then is the sound check. Bob Dylan sound checked the next day, Monday, December 1st in Atlanta. When we look at the soundtrack list, we see Some Blues, then Cold Iron's Bound, then The White Dove, the Stanley Brothers song, again The White Dove, the Stanley Brothers song, and Cocaine Blues. It's interesting. He plays Cold Iron's Bound and Junior soundtrack, and next The White Dove. Apparently, he still feels 10 months after he recorded the song, he still feels the strong connection of Cold Iron's Bound and the Stanley Brothers, which goes beyond The Fields Have Turned Brown. Because this third line in this song, the third line, "I went to church on Sunday and she passed by," almost literally from the Stanley versions of Handsome Molly. Handsome Molly is a very old folk song. Dylan played it in 1961 and 1962, but he always omitted this verse. "Well, I saw her at church last Sunday. She passed me on by." Almost exactly the same. "I knew her mind was changing by the roving of her eye." So he left that one out in 1961, but an omission Dylan makes up for almost 40 years later in Cold Iron's Bound.
"I saw her at church last Sunday, she passed me on by. I knew her mind was changing by the roving of her eye."
So all in all, we have The Fields Have Turned Brown, Handsome Molly, the theme and the tone of Stanley Brothers songs like If That's the Way You Feel, The Lonesome River, The Memory of Your Smile. We have words from It's Mighty Dark to Travel. We have words from I Hear a Voice Calling. it seems very likely that that day in January in 1997, on his way to the studio, Dylan had in his car the compilation album Stanley Series Volume 3, number 4. And that the chorus of the another Stanley Brothers song, I'll Fly Away, was buzzing through his head next. The chorus of that song of I'll Fly Away is No More Cold Iron Shackles on My Feet. I chose the Alison Krauss version because I didn't want to overdose on Stanley Brothers today, but Stanley Brothers sing the same. So we have arrived at the chorus. Chorus, I'm waist deep in the mist. It's almost like I don't exist. I'm 20 miles out of town and called Iron's Bound. That's a beautiful image. It's a very familiar image, but still a beautiful image. We all know this image from Wandering in the Mist in The Fog. We know it from, for example, from The Fog, from the John Carpenter horror movie from 1980, which, despite very poor reviews, was well received at the time, and since has become something of a cult classic. It's a story about a strange, luminous fog creeping into a coastal Californian town, this fog brings with it the vengeful spirits of the drowned sailors from 100 years ago. It's a very poetic tableau. The non-existent emerging from the mist, waist deep in the mist, almost like they don't exist. Apparently, Dylan recognizes it's poetic power too, and he explores here the metaphorical potential for the chorus in Cold Iron's Bound. So he sits there, inspired, next to the drumming David Kemper with his yellow pad of paper, and echoing in his mind are the songs from the Stanley Series Volume 3, number 4. I'm guessing he already had fixed this refrain line, I'm 20 miles out of town and called Iron's Bound. For this is another thing he reveals about his working method. This is what Dylan tells about his working method in 2020. In that particular song, the last few verses came first. So that's where the song was going all along. Obviously, the catalyst for the song is the title line. It's one of those where you write on instinct, kind of in a trance state. That's what Dylan says in 2020. He says it about the creation of I Contain Multitudes. It's from that New York Times interview with Douglas Brinkley. But the outpouring seems to apply one-to-one to Cold Iron's Bound. The last line, I'm 20 miles out of town in Cold Iron's Bound, was already there, before the previous one anyway. So we have David Kemper's inspiring drum pattern, and it just so happens that today the Stanley Brothers are buzzing through Dylan's mind, and via the fields have turned brown and handsome Molly, the stream of consciousness flows to I'll Fly Away to Cold Iron Shackles on My Feet, which perhaps awakens in Cold Iron's Bound. By the way, this exact combination of words, it can be found in a very, very old folk song, in a Scottish folk song, The Banks of Inverness from the 16th century. But I doubt if he knew that. Strong metaphor, anyway, the poet thinks. To express bound against your will, to express the state of mind of his protagonist, the I person who is lovesick, who is standing on the doorway, who is about to hit the dirt road. The particular choice of words by the musician Dylan is then, I suppose, as so often, mainly sound-driven. So this guy is not on the road in iron shackles. He's not like the worried man in Worried Life Blues, in Worried Man Blues. He's not 21 links of chain around my leg on the Rocky Mountain line. Dylan searches and finds a superior assonant triplet around the ow sound, out, town, bound. I'm guessing he's a musician, so I suppose he hears the assonant, the sound-driven out-town bound. The bridge to this refrain line is not fixed. He's inspired. I think he trusts the richness of his stream of consciousness. So he chooses different images, different words in each of the five refrains to express this loneliness, this quiet desperation of his unhappy protagonist. Here in this first refrain, it's the desolate image of disoriented people wandering around through the fog, and which has a symbolic power that is recognized by artists for centuries, and by Dylan as well, of course. Unusual repetition in these two choruses, that gives some credence to Kemper's story that was written in 10 minutes. I think it's probably more or less true that this is 10 minutes. Though it's likely that Dylan is a compulsive scribbler and a compulsive note taker. I suppose he had a few one-liners up his sleeve. The refrain line, 20 miles out of town and called Irons Bound. And a verse line like, my love for her is taking such a long way to die. They have a polished perfection. It suggests that they were already a while in the making. And in the next verse, we have this marble elegance of this decaying beauty aphorism. It's such a sad thing to see beauty decay. It's sadder still to feel your heart torn away. It's too beautiful. I suppose it didn't come out of the blue either. Still, this atypical repetitio in these couplet lines, waist deep, and almost like, it's kind of a stopgap solution of an artist who is in a flow, who doesn't want to lose his momentum. So he quickly fills in the empty syllables with repetition. It's a bit atypical for the poet Dylan, but it's a tenpenny style characteristic for the Sandy Brothers, like in Rank Strangers. Everybody I met seemed to be a rank stranger, No mother or dad, not a friend I could see, Endless repetitions. They knew not my name, and they knew not their faces. I found they were all rank strangers to me. This was only the first couplet. It's a very, very rich and a very inspiring song. As Craig said, I've just written a book on this album. I think this song alone is 6 or 7 chapters. Should you be interested, buy the book, but you can also read it for free. I think most of the chapters, maybe all of the chapters, are published on the British side from Tony Atwood on Untold Dylan. There you can see what I have found in the other 5 stanzas. Back to you, Craig.
That's fantastic. How do you listen to the album or listen to these kind of songs having all this rich depth? Meaning, are you constantly checking all your references, or do you put those aside and listen?
Oddly, the most, when I have associations or when I think, hey, I've heard this before, it's mostly in covers. Not so much when I listen to the original album, but when I listen to a cover of Nor Dark Yet, or to a cover of Love Physique. I love covers. I have a lot of them. But then somehow I seem to be able to detach myself from the recording and hear a familiar word combination or a familiar guitar lick. And then I start looking. Usually it is through covers. But I understand what you're saying. The danger is a bit when you that you can't enjoy the music anymore, when you are overanalyzing. I admit I do feel that sometimes, that when I start to dig too deep in a song, I can't enjoy it anymore. When I found he stole this from that song and he stole this guitar lick from whoever, from some blues great, that could spoil the enjoyment of the song, but it isn't like that. Apparently, when I listen to Dylan, I can block that out and I enjoy the song.
What impact do you think this should have on people? Or I'm just trying to think about how people start to process it, who are just for the first time realizing, you know, that Bob's synthesizing all these influences and echoing. And
we know what the reaction is from a lot of fans. A lot of fans, and Scott Walmart can testify this, are appalled. They leave a nasty messages on Scott's website. Think this is rubbish and idiocy, but I admire that, and it's what all great artists do. It's what T.S. Eliot already said: great artists steal. It's true, and they steal. Homer stole, Shakespeare stole, Romeo and Juliet is stolen from, well, most of it is stolen from an older Bertolt Brecht stole that all the great artists steal and create new art. I think it's a bit like what a miner is. A miner finds nuggets and a goldsmith can make precious jewels from it. And that's what Bob Dylan does. He finds nuggets and he crafts it into a great jewelry. I admire that.
So for most fans who weren't aware of it, it's a chance to see more shades of gray, understand there's more things going on. It's adding, obviously, I totally agree. Obviously, it's not detracting, it's adding. It's just an interesting process for fans who weren't aware. And you know, your book, as I said, I spent, you know, some of the last week reading the first couple chapters, and Time Out of Mind, I've certainly listened to, you know, hundreds of times, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, this is there and this is from there. And then I've got a whole new playlist I've started building of your, you know, reference songs. And it's very fun to listen to that way. I'm going to publish the full list, actually. You know, I may just do a special one from your book because there's so many in there, but, I do think it helps people. I just think it's an interesting to
I think it's very enriching.
Talk about it, have people.
It's very enriching. Yeah. When I read, with Scott, for example, what he has found, I go and buy these books and I read these books. And when I read with another guy who wrote that he finds little water traces in the songs from these particular songs, I go and to Spotify and listen to all the little water songs. And I didn't know them. It is enriching. It opens doors to a lot of other great artists.
Right. So in your process, I mean, you know, Scott works a certain way. And as we talked to Scott about this a few weeks ago, you know, he noticed the floodgate of a certain kind of influence post Masked and Anonymous. And, you know, he started Love and Theft and worked back to Time Out of Mind. You've obviously looked at the full catalog. How do you see the influences on Dylan, you know, changing over time? Meaning, are the first 20 or 30 years,
definitely,
you know, for you, is there equally a demarcation after Time Out of Mind and before in terms of the kind or the way they're used? Yes.
I think from Time Out of Mind, he starts to quote literally. Before that, it's mainly influence, very strong influence. But in songs like Visions of Johanna and most 60 songs, you can find, but you cannot exactly pinpoint Rimbaud or Baudelaire or Brecht. You can feel it. It's there. But it's not literally there. Song like When the Ship Comes In, that's Brecht. But you can't find one single line in the oeuvre from Brecht which corresponds with this song. And that has changed since Time Out of Mind. Since Time Out of Mind, you can find literal quotes in the work of other great artists. And I'm not sure, I haven't checked Under the Red Sky, for example. Maybe there too. But I think that's the demarcation line. There he starts to quote and paraphrase quite literally, which I love.
Well, Michael Gray, who's here with us today, the day this is going to play live anyway, recently tweeted about Under the Red Sky, something about references to 20 nursery rhymes. Yeah. Like, but he mentioned it as literal. So we're going to ask him about it since he's here.
The album, it consists of nursery rhymes, and they sound very familiar and old-fashioned, like English nursery rhymes from the 18th and 19th century, but I haven't looked yet. And of course, he has done it before on Empire Burlesque, for example, the movie quotes, not so systematically as in Time Out of Mind, and since Time Out of Mind, like Scott has found in the movie, Mask and Anonymous, and in the book Chronicles, dozens and dozens and dozens of literal quotations and paraphrases.
Right.
It's interesting.
So maybe it's further in your book than I am, but do you subscribe to the theory that Time Out of Mind really is a cohesive whole, and that it's kind of one story told from different angles or different aspects of a story, and that there's a arc from beginning to end, more so than other Dylan albums?
Well, I think other guys in your show have said this better than I can. I don't think it's a story. It's certainly not epic. in the literal sense. It doesn't tell a story. It's impressionist. It's lyrical. He conveys feelings. And of course, anyone can hear that and anyone can see that the whole album conveys the feeling of a jaded man looking back on his life. That's not very difficult to see. But other guys can tell it and say that better than I can. So I really mainly focus on songs and hardly on the album as a whole.
Okay, and how have you seen or experienced the live performances of these songs? How do you think? How does the live versions affect your view of this album?
I almost always think that the album versions are superior. An exception is the Cold Irons Bound version in the movie in the Mask and Anonymous. It's a very hard word for me to say, Anonymous. That's really a beautiful version. I heard a lot of versions of these songs from shows that weren't his best years, 2003, 2004, 2005. The songs were even, there wasn't much passion in it. Maybe that's the wrong word to use. So I always listen to the complete shows, and I especially listen to the songs I love, of course, the Time Out of Mind songs and the Street Legal songs, which are never played, except for Senor. But I always go back to the studio versions. I so far I haven't heard a superior live version, except this one in the movie, to one of the album versions. I don't know how it's for you, but what have you heard?
And I was lucky to see some of the late 97 shows when that stuff was new, and he was obviously, you know, intense about it. The Irving Plaza show here in New York was, you know, there's a soundboard actually, which is nice. So you know, it's all an embarrassment of riches. And then we have Telltale Signs, a whole lot more. And then I wanted to ask you, you know, the rumor is we're going to get a bootleg series. Anything you're particularly looking forward to or hoping to find or see or be revealed there?
I hope it won't contain an extra song. It would mean that I would have to rewrite the book. So I really hope this is authorless. I suspect we get some extra outtakes. There seems to be another outtake from a Red River Shore, and there seems to be an even longer outtake from Highlands. I suppose we can expect something like that. But there's one thing I hope is that it won't have something, that it won't have an extra song.
Yeah. I guess last question, you know, the fact that this is 25 years, how do you look at this album when you look back over the whole career?
I named my book The Rising of an Old Master, and I translated the book to Dutch and to German, and I chose almost exactly the same subtitles, The Rising of an Old Master. I don't want to brag, but I think that's a good title. This is where Dylan has become an old master. In German, that's really an honorary title to be called. With Goethe, we call it, for example, his Altersdichtung. This is the poetry he makes as an older man. Altersdichtung, one word. And I looked for something in English to express exactly that. And I think the rising of an old master, the beginning of an old master, the genesis of an old master could all be. The rising has an evangelical connotation to it, so I like that. That's what I really think. This is the point where he starts to become an old master, not only for me and for you, but for the whole world. From this point on, Dylan is beyond criticism. From this point on, every album sells extremely well. All the concerts are sold out. From this point on, he gets Oscars and Nobel Prizes and Grammys and you name it. From this point on, he's beyond criticism. From this point on, he's recognized as an old master. This is the starting point.
Everyone who cares about this album really needs to grab this book. It's on Amazon. I don't know if is there Kindle or only physical?
Kindle 2.
Kindle 2.
And then hardcover.
Thanks for that contribution to the world of Dylan, and thank you so much for talking to us today.
My pleasure, Greg. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening.